Students walk in the classroom and they feel very proud. I have posters, charts everywhere. We're bilingual, and I ask, you know, ¿qué somos? What are we? We're bilingual. They're very, very proud. They know that, you know, being bilingual is a superpower. We have a daily mantra every day. We talk about, you know, we're strong, we're smart, we're bilingual. And they keep repeating it every day, and they believe it.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis, and if it sounds a little strange this morning, that's because we are on the road. It is conference season, the beginning of the school year, and today I am coming to you from a hotel room in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You just heard the voice of Sonia Aguila, a California dual language teacher who has been recognized in her district, her state, and nationally for the work she has done in the field of multilingual education. Born in Santa Barbara, California, Sonia Aguila grew up in a small town near Guadalajara, Mexico. She returned to California at age 11, only knowing how to count to 10 in English. After experiencing many challenges and even being discouraged from pursuing a higher education as a young student, she was eventually selected as her high school salutatorian and Latino Student of the Year at the University of California in Santa Barbara. She followed her lifelong dream of becoming a teacher after obtaining an elementary teaching credential with an emphasis in Spanish and a master's degree in education. Sonia is currently a second grade dual language immersion teacher at Catalino Elementary School and the dual language immersion chairperson for Carpinteria Unified School District in California, where she co-wrote the Plan Maestro for the dual language immersion program. She was the Carpinteria Unified School District Teacher of the Year in 2017, the California Bilingual Teacher of the Year in 2022, and the National Bilingual Teacher of the Year in 2023. She is also a radio host, producer, and director of Festival Infantil, which is a children's radio show on Radio Bronco 107.7 FM. She's a Latino newspaper education columnist and a mentor teacher through the University of California in Santa Barbara and Westmont College. All that, and as a true lifelong learner, she is currently pursuing a PhD. I talked with her about how she has applied the lessons she learned from growing up as a multilingual learner and how not to repeat some of the same mistakes that her teachers made, as she is now a dual language educator working with many of the same kinds of students. We also talked about how teachers can use relationship building to improve learning outcomes for hesitant and disconnected students and students who have real problems in the classroom, of which there are obviously many. And we also talked about how we can encourage our students to embrace and celebrate their bilingualism, which is something that we talk about quite frequently, but Sonia has a lot of really practical strategies that she shares with us in this conversation. As always, thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Sonia Aguila. Sonia Aguila, thank you so much for joining us on Highest Aspirations.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. A pleasure being here.
Yeah, we learned about you. I forget where the article was that I read, but I read about the work that you're doing. And I was at CABE last year, and I'm pretty tight with NABE as well, and learned that you were named Teacher of the Year by both CABE and NABE. That's California Association of Bilingual Education and the National Association of Bilingual Education, for your work in advocating on behalf of bilingual students and their families. So congratulations on that. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A dream come true. And I'm happy to now be able to share my story and inspire students.
Yeah. And let's start there. And I'll be honest with you. Normally we don't do that, but I really want to start there for this conversation because I think it's really important. And it sounds like it's something that has sort of shaped your journey, both as a student and now as a teacher and a nationally recognized one. So I'm going to start this way. You were told, according to the article that I read, you were told by a school counselor that college wasn't for you, and that was due to your English proficiency. That's a story that we've heard before.
Pretty sad.
It is. And hopefully we're hearing it less and less, and people like you are doing amazing work to make sure that that is the case. But how, because that experience can really shape someone in a variety of different ways on a large spectrum. It can inspire somebody to say, you know what, I have a chip on my shoulder, I'm going for it, you can't tell me what to do. But for other people, it can really stunt their growth. So my question is, how has that experience, how did it affect you, first of all? And how has it shaped your approach as an educator, particularly in supporting students who face similar challenges?
So a little background, I was born in California. We moved to Mexico when I was 5 years old. My grandpa became sick, and so we moved to Mexico. And I went to elementary school in Mexico. My grandpa passed away. We came back when I was 11 without speaking a word of English. Mm-hmm. I used to cry every day. I didn't want to be here. I wanted to go back to Mexico. I missed my friends, my teacher, my house, my bed. It was a culture shock. Then my counselor called me and said, I don't think college is for you. You don't speak English well. You have an accent.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should find a job and help your parents. And I went home and I cried. I cried for 3 days. I knew since I was 5 that I wanted to be a teacher. And so to hear this counselor tell me that, you know, your English is not, you're not fluent and you have an accent.
And how old were you, Sonia, at this time?
I was in high school.
Yeah.
A senior in high school, struggling with the language and the culture. And so after I cried for 3 days, I signed up for college. I said, no, I'm doing this. I'm going to go to college. So after that, I became Latino Student of the Year in college, transferred to a 4-year university. I obtained my teaching credential and my master's degree for free, absolutely free. I never paid a penny. I received lots of scholarships. So this experience, how did it change me? As a teacher, I encourage students to go to college, to be anything they want to be. I tell them, con ganas, you know, if there's a will, you can do it. So I became an advocate for second language learners. You know, if I can do it, they can do it as well. And as a mother, I have 3 children. They know that college is not optional. We're going to college.
Yeah.
I am now getting my PhD, and my son keeps asking, Mom, does that mean I need to get a PhD? Yes, go get 2. Bring 2 home. You can do it. But that was a life-changing, you know, experience. And I'm using it now in a positive way to encourage my students and, you know, anybody actually to just go and follow your dream. Don't let people tell you, no, you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great foundation to build on. And what occurred to me, you know, I had mentioned when I first asked you the question that there's a wide spectrum of how this kind of response from a counselor could affect somebody. And obviously it affected you profoundly. You said you cried for 3 days, but at the end of 3 days, you somehow found a way to just say, you know, I'm doing it, and you know, and you did it. What advice do you give to a student through no fault of their own falls on the other side of that spectrum, where that really brings them down and they may cry for 3 days, but really believe that in their hearts, what was told by the counselor? I mean, how do we and how do you go about, for lack of a better term, counseling those students? I mean, I know you teach elementary, right?
I do. I teach second grade. But I also keep the parents informed. A lot of the parents think college is so expensive, I cannot afford it. And so I inform families too. So hopefully they can also encourage their children. I do that by writing articles, education articles for a local newspaper. I also am a radio host for a children's program. And so
I didn't know that. That's amazing. Tell me about that. I'm going to just a little detour here.
I started doing radio 26 years ago. I knew I wanted to teach, and I needed 45 hours of pre-professional work around children. And there was a radio station a block from my house, and I decided to just visit one Saturday morning. And I was very shy, and I knew radio's not for me. I am not doing radio. I'm just here to, I need my 45 hours. Mm-hmm. Of pre-professional work. And then one Saturday, the radio host left and said, you know, the show is yours. And I said, no, I'm not doing this. I want to teach. But she said, no, who better? You know, you should do it. You should totally do it. So someone trained me, and I used to write every single thing I was going to say.
Yeah.
I before, you know, in Spanish, buenos días, ¿cómo están? Bienvenidos. I would write everything and read.
Yep.
I used to shake when, you know, they would open the mic. But yeah, it's been 26 years. I'm still there and I enjoy it. I get to talk to students from all over the county, and it's wonderful.
Amazing. That's amazing. That's sorry for that little detour there, but I couldn't resist asking because it's such an interesting way to get your voice, you know, out there and your perspective and connect with the community, which I think is obviously a big part of the work that we do as educators.
Yes.
And building those relationships, I'm sure, has been really important for you, both personally and I'm sure professionally as well, working in schools.
Yes. Another way I connect with the community is through the newspaper. I write articles for the Spanish newspaper. And again, I want to teach. I don't want to write. I don't want to. But someone came to interview me at the radio station, and I mentioned I want to write a book. I want to be an author someday. It's, you know, bucket list. And they said, why don't you write for the paper? And I said, no.
Again,
Started writing for the newspaper, so I write articles in Spanish. I'm in charge of the education section, so that's another way I can also, you know, invite parents, inform parents to send their kids to college. You know, yes, it is expensive, but there's ways. I went to college for free.
Great. Well, so getting back to sort of your work as an educator now, one of the most important things that we can do as educators, I think, is to build strong relationships with the students that we work with. It is this episode will be going out sort of at the beginning of the school year here, and that's something that we're thinking a lot about, but that's a long-term process, right? It's not just the beginning of the year, but that's something that needs to be fostered throughout. So my question for you is, when you encounter students who may be experiencing discouragement or self-doubt, a lot of multilingual learners like yourself experienced at that time, how do you help them? How do you build those relationships to help them overcome those obstacles that they face early in your case in their educational journeys?
I'm thinking of a student I had. This is my 25th, 26. I've been 26 years in education, and I've had a lot of students, but one in particular, you know, I love this student. He taught me so much. This student was very, you know, he was very defiant, didn't want to go to school. I would pass papers and he would just throw them, you know, on the floor. He would break pencils. He would flip tables. He would leave the classroom. He didn't want to be, clearly did not want to be my student.
Maybe not your student, maybe just in
And
school at that time.
I wanted him to sit down and learn and do your work, to finish your assignments. No. So I learned the hard way that relationships come first. He taught me that you need to have a relationship with students. And I read a quote somewhere that students don't learn from teachers they don't like. And so we became friends first. I invited him to come to my classroom to have lunch. And he said, you know, like lunch with the teacher? Are you kidding me? No way. And then one day he showed up with his tray, with his lunch tray. I found out he loved dinosaurs. So I read books about dinosaurs. I brought puzzles, toys, everything about dinosaurs, and little by little we became friends. And then he started to learn. But he was pretty challenging. At one point, I had the principal, I had this counselor, the psychologist, and the custodian chasing him. He would jump the fence and leave school. But relationships, and now I'm a veteran teacher, and that's what I. The first thing I tell my student teachers, I have student teachers every year, and I tell them, you need to have that relationship. Yes, you want them to learn. You need to have that relationship first before they learn. That was he taught me so much. I think he taught me more than I taught him.
Yeah, I could say that a lot of students taught me more than I taught them, particularly in my first few years of teaching. I taught high school Spanish. I'm not a heritage teacher of, I mean, not a heritage speaker of Spanish. And I taught in a district where the vast majority of students were. And so I was teaching Spanish to native speakers of Spanish. And most of them were from the Dominican Republic, and they taught me a tremendous amount. In fact, probably the way that I speak Spanish is a mix between the Castellano in Spain, where I studied, and the strange hybrid of also this Dominican piece that I learned from them. So it's funny.
Pretty neat. And I wanted to mention that they're not my students just 1 year. They're always my students. They're forever my students. I keep in touch with them, and now with social media, it's so easy. But I teach second grade, and I write letters to my seniors when they graduate.
Oh, that's amazing.
They get a letter from me. They keep in touch. And now, you know, teaching 25, 26 years, I'm teaching my students' kids.
Yeah.
Which is pretty, pretty neat.
I never got there, but it's funny. I think about it when you said 26 years. And actually, this, I think, would have been if I had stayed teaching my 25th or 26th year coming up, because I've been at Elevation now for 7 and I taught for 17. Which is crazy to think. So I guess no, a little less, 24. My math's off, which is not uncommon. So let me ask you, let me push back a little bit, or dig a little deeper is probably a better way to put it, on what you said earlier about, you know, I couldn't help but notice you said the word friends, right, with your students. A lot of teachers would say, well, friends, like, what do you mean? How can you can't be friends? So, and I know, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about sort of how you're using that term and what you mean by that. But I guess that the heart of my question is really, like, when you think about, as teachers are going back to school this year, especially, I think, in the last couple of years, there's this balance with the need for academic progress and testing and everything else, and the importance of addressing social emotional well-being for students, especially considering what's happened over the last few years. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about balancing that? And how does that sort of connect, if it does connect, to what you talked about like being friends and having connections that way?
Yeah. So like I said, I, as a new teacher, I wanted the students to sit down and listen and focus and do your work and follow directions. But, you know, again, this student taught me that relation, just the power of relationships, that has to be present, that has to be first. And on the first day of school, students can either give me a high five or a hug. And not too many want the hug. They just, you know, like, yeah, I'm not going to hug you.
Yeah, yeah.
By the end of the week, I have everybody hugging. I like to give hugs. But I do look at the whole child. And by that, I mean their social, emotional. I need to know what is happening at home. During the pandemic, it was really sad. I found out when I deliver packets to the homes, there were 3-4 families living, you know, together, students without food. So what I do is I bring snacks for those that don't bring snacks, water. You need to look at all their social, emotional, how are they feeling? Every morning when I take attendance, I take a look, you know, see how they're feeling. You know, are they sleepy? Are they tired? Are they hungry? If they didn't eat, then I send them to the cafeteria for breakfast. So all that is important. Yes, I want them to learn, and I do have pretty high standards. But you need to address all those things. And the pandemic was wide opening. I mean, eye opening. We just so sad to see how they live, how their situations and what they go through at home. Sometimes you have no clue what's happening at home. I kept telling a student, bring a snack. You need to bring a snack. Well, there's 3, 4, 5 families. They rent the living room, so they don't really have access to the kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how, you know, we're still talking about it now, but the whole situation with the pandemic, while the world was actually shut down and most people didn't get to see too much out of their own house, educators were actually granted a rare glimpse into the homes, either via Zoom or, in your case, it sounds like delivering packets or meeting people at sort of drop-off sites. So it really, in many ways, I think, kind of gave us probably some of the motivation that we needed to make sure that we're doing the things that you're talking about doing now, which is developing those relationships. And I love what you said about in the morning when it's attendance time, really taking a look. And those are all investments in time, and time's precious. And they can be very easily it can be very easy to persuade yourself to skip it because you have so much to do. But it sounds like you've over time developed systems and routines to make that happen. And the other piece, kind of transitioning here into, you know, the other thing that we need to know about here, and I'm really interested to hear your perspective on it, is not just who students are as people. Part of their what they bring with them is obviously any language assets or barriers in some cases that they bring, and then cultural differences. And when you're working in a school, when you're lucky enough to work in a school that's so diverse like that, you also have to understand all of those cultures and those language differences, et cetera. So how have you, I'm going to call them challenges, even though I'd rather refer to them as assets and benefits. But for the case of this question, I'm going to address it as a challenge. How have you addressed those challenges in order to create like an inclusive and supportive learning environment for everybody?
6 years ago, we started a dual language program. And so I'm very empathetic now. I'm very empathetic with students. We have students that don't speak Spanish. And that was the case for me. I didn't speak English when I was in high school. So I'm very empathetic. I make sure they have a partner. I make sure they have visuals. We do songs. I do small groups to meet the needs. But, you know, as a second language learner, I'm really empathetic. And again, I look at the whole child, what is happening at home. And how are they, you know, parents just sometimes drop off the kids and don't communicate with us. You know, they don't tell us my child cried all morning or my child didn't sleep. So it's up to
us. And some of that, by the way, is also cultural as well, right?
Right, right. But again, this DLI, dual language class there, you know, we have students from different cultures, different languages, and the goal is to for them to become bilingual, biliterate, bicultural. So, and then I try to integrate a lot of multicultural books. We want students to learn about, you know, other cultures, not just the language. So I keep talking about this DLI program. We're really proud of our program. We started 6 years ago. It was challenging at the beginning. We had to convince the board to approve this dual language program. I work at a small district, and they didn't want to divide the schools and the districts and all that. But we're really proud. Yeah, students are bilingual, biliterate. It's pretty awesome to see them, you know, reading and writing in two languages.
Yeah, and that's obviously something you're very proud of. You've mentioned it a few times. So let's talk about it a little bit. I mean, there are many school districts out there and schools that are trying to do this that are facing resistance from a variety of places. I know, and we were talking before we hit the record button, that I knew I would do this. I knew I'd want to talk about this. I had a question written. I said, you know, Sonia, this is a whole podcast episode in and of itself, but now I can't resist because I think it's such an important thing for people to hear. What were, if you think about that challenge, like, I guess I have sort of three parts of the question. One is, what were the top strategies that you used to sort of convince all stakeholders that this is something that is worth doing and that we should do? Two, how did you navigate the very real transformation of school and seeing a lot more kids really wide-eyed and being like, oh my God, what's happening? This is a totally different language. And then three, how, it sounds like it's successful. When did you realize that it was a success and how do you maintain it? I'll remind you of those questions if there's a lot, but just you can get started and I'll remind you if I need to.
It was a group of 20 parents. White English only parents that wanted this program. They wanted their children to be bilingual. They knew the benefits of being bilingual, and they started collecting signatures. We went to the board. The board said, again, we're a small district. We don't want to divide the population. We don't want to do that. Go do research, come back. So that's what we did. We went to other schools. We went to schools that are so ahead of us. They've been teaching dual language for years. Mm-hmm. And we went back to the board and we said, we're ready. We want to do this. Being bilingual is the future is bilingual. There's nothing negative. Let's do it. And they said, let's wait. We finally convinced the board. And so we started 6 years ago, our dual language program. We're really proud. We just sent our first cohort to the middle school.
Oh, wow. That's right.
They speak English and Spanish and they write. It's just amazing. Some of the challenges, just finding Spanish resources has been challenging. But the biggest, we're creating a lot of the curriculum too and looking at other districts, what other districts are using. But I think the biggest challenge is finding bilingual teachers.
Yeah, that's what I figured you'd say.
There's a teacher shortage. And so imagine looking for a bilingual teacher. That has been a challenge. Another challenge is also the makeup of the class. So the classes are supposed to be composed of 8 bilingual, 8 Spanish, and 8 English. And so we're having a hard time convincing the Hispanic families to put the kids in dual language. They are here. They want their kids to learn English.
Mm, yeah. There's a misconception that if they're still using their own language, they're not learning enough English. Yeah.
Maestra, I can teach Spanish at home. Yes, but it's not the academic Spanish. It's a different Spanish. So now our classes are more heavy, more dominant with English only students. And so we're trying to attract those families and convince them how powerful it is for them to read and write, not just speak Spanish, but really become bilingual, bicultural. We found out the program was very successful. We're working with the University of California, Santa Barbara, and they're doing research, and they come every year. They assess the students, and students are ahead by a year.
Wow.
Ahead from their peers. And so that way we know that we're being successful. And also other schools are coming to see what we're doing. And so that feels great.
That's full circle. You were doing that before and now they're doing it. And the research, the micro research that you're doing in your district reflects the greater research that's being done. So that is so sad. It's going to be so satisfying for you. Must be so proud.
Awesome. And we're growing. We started with 2 kindergarten classrooms and now there's 2 every grade. And again, we're sending them to the middle school and already making plans with the high school because we want them to, at the end, get their seal of biliteracy when they graduate.
Yeah.
They get their seal that they're bilingual.
That's amazing. And the seal of biliteracy is such, we've done a few episodes now that I've spoken with Martha Hernandez from California's Together and others on the podcast about it. And it's such an incredible program and one that actually we implemented at my school in Massachusetts 10 years ago for students of that were learning Spanish as a foreign language. And back then when we were trying to do it, I never realized like the rich history and how that kind of came about. And it just creates an environment where being bilingual and biliterate is valued on a whole other level. And it creates a structure and checkpoints that allow you to really convince those that may need a little bit more convincing. And of course, recognize those students who come from such a diverse backgrounds at the end of their academic journey. And it's sometimes along the way.
Right.
So that's one way that seal biology is one way to sort of, like I said, so I kind of convince people and make it sort of official, for lack of a better term. But you said something a minute ago that was interesting, and that was that, you know, you had a hard time and you're still maybe having a hard time convincing parents of your Hispanic students that this is a good idea, dual language. And I totally understand that. I hear that pretty frequently. So my question for you then becomes, how do you go about, I mean, you have a commitment of your own to inspiring and empowering bilingual individuals, right? That's your kind of life's work mission, it sounds to me like, which is very worthwhile.
All right.
So I was going to ask you originally, how do you encourage your students to embrace their bilingualism and view it as a valuable asset in their personal academic lives? I'll still ask you that because I'm sure some of what parents' beliefs are trickle down to their kids, of course. But how do you do that for community members and parents as well? Like, expand a little bit on how you've risen to that challenge, or have you? Has that continued to be like really difficult to get the proportions that you want in the dual language program?
Students walk in the classroom and they feel very proud. I have posters, charts everywhere. We're bilingual, and I I ask, you know, ¿qué somos? What are we? We're bilingual. They're very, very proud. They know that, you know, being bilingual is a superpower. We have a daily mantra every day. We talk about, you know, we're strong, we're smart, we're bilingual. And they keep repeating it every day and they believe it. And so we use it every day. And even at the beginning, I'm going to be very honest, the school was divided. We had teachers that, you know, were not, they were a little against, you know, DLI, but it was all just fear of losing their job, fear that they were going to, you know, now they're going to move me to another grade, they're going to move me to another school. But it's a really popular program. It's a very small district, small community, and the word is getting out there. And now, you know, by being the National Bilingual Teacher of the Year, everybody knows about our district. And so again, we're really proud. We have the support of our board members, families. We have a lot of families that are interested in our program. We just need to convince our Hispanic families that, you know, in the long run, you know, this is, they, students need to be bilingual, biliterate, bicultural, not just speak. I have family members that are not fluent in Spanish. You know, the parents speak Spanish and they, you know, they don't. And so they're the language, they're losing the language. Mm-hmm. Last name is Gonzalez, Fernandez, and they do not speak Spanish. And so we're really, really proud of this program. It works. It works. By sixth grade, they're fully bilingual and you know, fluent in two languages. So the way it works is it's a 90-10 program. In kindergarten, 90% of the day is in Spanish and then 10% in English. And then every year the percentage changes. So in first grade, it's 80-20, then it's 70-30, mm-hmm. 40-60, and then 50-50. It's pretty awesome, pretty neat.
There are, it never ceases to amaze me how many different types of programs there are. And so thank you for describing what yours is, because what works in one district in one place doesn't necessarily work in the other. I mean, the formula or the basic idea that the goal, I guess I should say, that we want all of our students to be bilingual and biliterate is a good one. The way that you get there is different in every district.
Yeah, there's other programs. There's 50-50, which is really popular too, the 50-50 model, where half of the day they speak English and half of the day Spanish, or one day is English and another day is Spanish. But the problem, the concern with that is that students will wait for the English time to speak. And so during Spanish, they're quiet. They're not participating. They wait for that special time to participate. And we don't want that. We want them using both languages. And we don't want teachers saying, oh, it's not time for Spanish right now. Oh, it's English time. Yeah,
because you have to have, I mean, the goal is really to have students be comfortable in both languages and do that whole translanguaging thing even, and everything that we hear about now and all the research.
Very controversial, translanguaging.
It is. I said it and I said, ooh, somebody's going to, yeah. I consider, this might be like me defending myself, but I consider myself very much a generalist, and I get to talk with people like you who are experts in the field, and so I pick up on a variety of different things. But yes, it's not lost on me that is definitely a controversial term. Another conversation for another time. Yes. I have one more question for you, and this interview, as I figured it would, has kind of taken a turn toward dual language, and that's fine. When we talk about, you've mentioned this before as we've spoken, when we talk about being bilingual and being proud of bilingual, how do you convince, I keep using the word convince, how do you sort of get across to your students and to everybody involved that being bilingual is not just about being able to have a conversation with friends, and to be able to be in a social situation. Of course, what I'm referring to here is what you've mentioned, which is academic language. How do you kind of like build that in a way that is sustainable, and in a way that there's some accountability for understanding that, yes, these students are able to carry on a conversation in both languages, but are also able to perform at grade level or higher in content areas?
Yes, so the goal of, you know, our bilingual program, our DLI program, dual language immersion, is for students to be bilingual, biliterate, bicultural. And so not just I can speak in two languages, we also teach them, you know, we talk about cultures. We learn about Chinese New Year. We celebrate Las Posadas from Mexico. We make tamales in class. We learn about Frida Kahlo, Hispanic Heritage Month, Black History Month. So it's pretty wonderful. I am working on a multicultural library. I want students to see when I read a book, hey, that author, you know, looks like me. I look like that author,
yeah.
Or I look like that character. So that's my goal this year, to find more multicultural books. But again, not just reading. That's not being bilingual, speaking, you know, two languages. We want to make sure that students are bicultural as well. So it's pretty neat. We love learning about, you know, Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera and making tamales around Christmas time. We read about, you know, tamales. I bring families, volunteers. We make tamales in class. You know, children learn by doing things, and they remember those things. When I was learning English in high school, and this was in high school, I remember the teacher singing, so lots of songs and visuals and charts. And I always had, she assigned another student to help me. And so I make sure I continue, you know, with those strategies. I assign this student a support person. So every student has a support person, and they chose chips and salsa. So find your chip, find your salsa, your partner. And we help each other. They translate for each other. It's pretty awesome. It's a pretty nice environment. You know, when I'm in the classroom, it doesn't feel like I'm working. It's my second home.
That's a beautiful thing. You know, as you were talking about the teacher that you had in high school that was singing all the time, and you sort of emulating some of that and knowing it works, I think that's a really interesting observation that I have pretty frequently. And I observed it in myself, which is that we, as a teacher, I sort of thought about, and I started early and I didn't have much training. I was kind of thrown in. But I thought, okay, well, what do my teachers do? And I went in and I kind of did what they did. And I can't say that I did everything that they did that was effective. I just kind of did what they did. And over time, I started to realize, wait a minute, the teacher that was singing, like the one that you mentioned, that was really effective. The one that was standing in front of the class that I'm emulating, conjugating verbs, that was actually not very effective. So it takes a while to sort it out and figure out, you know, which of your inspiration was good inspiration and which one's just kind of stuck in your head because there's this rote kind of like process that happened over and over again. But it's nice to hear you talking about the ones that did inspire you and emulating those things, because it's such a wonderful thing when you can look back and say something was effective for me as a multilingual learner. Now I'm going to use it for my own students.
And I'm a veteran teacher now. There's so many young teachers, but I've been, you know, at Canalino School for 26 years, and now I'm lucky I get to work with student teachers, and I tell them, come learn from my mistakes. Learn from my mistakes. You know, not everything is going to work. And every year the class is different. What works one year might not work the second year. So it's pretty awesome. It's something I'm very passionate about. I really enjoy what I do. And again, it doesn't feel like I'm working. Yes, it's stressful. Yes, a lot of teachers left during the pandemic. They're getting paid more somewhere else. But I'm just really passionate about, you know, what I do. It's something I can retire in 4 years, and I don't know if I'm going to.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm sure if you do decide to do that, you'll still be in the space, because it sounds like you're getting a PhD right now. And so you're also a lifelong learner. Am I right? What are you pursuing for a PhD?
In education. I don't, it's always been, you know, an idea, a dream to get a PhD. But of course I wanted to send my son to college first. That was a priority. But he was lucky that he got so many scholarships too. And I said, oh, I think I can afford to do a PhD, and I just finished year one. It's not easy, you know, working full time, being a mom, doing the radio, doing the newspaper, and taking three classes for my PhD. It's really a lot, but it's doable, and I am really enjoying, you know, learning from others, and it's all online from the university UTEL. It's the number one university in Mexico. And it's been wonderful, a wonderful learning opportunity. I'm a lifelong learner. I'm learning. There's so much to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's amazing. And then, as you said, your children are going to get two PhDs each, right?
Yeah. They tell me, Mom, the bar is too high. You're raising the bar. Yes. I need a PhD? Yes.
There's no such thing. Great. Well, Sonia, so there's a lot, you know, I've read a lot of articles about you being Teacher of the Year and learned a lot about you that way. And obviously this learned a lot more of this conversation. There's a lot that we can take out of this. But if people want to learn more about sort of the work that you're doing, is there a place that they could go to, or an article or anything that they could look at to learn more?
So I don't have Instagram. I'm working on it. I only have, I know my kids laugh at me. They're like, Mom, you don't have Instagram. I don't have Instagram. I do have Facebook. And they tell me Facebook is for old people. I don't know. But Facebook, I have a Maestra Aguila website. And the way that started was I wasn't really into social media. I don't have time.
Me neither. I'm with you.
But I had a one of my listeners at the radio moved to Mexico, and she said, Maestra, I'm not going to be able to listen to your so every hour at the radio they have a parenting tip, the Maestra Aguila's parenting tip. It airs every hour, and she said, I'm going to miss that. I'm not going to hear you. Why don't you start, you know, your Facebook page? And I said, no. I finally did it. Just because of her, I did it. And so they can follow me on Facebook, Maestra Aguila. I'll work on Instagram. Work on it. But yeah, there's a few articles out there now with this national award. There's a few articles.
Yeah, and we'll link to a couple of those in the blog post and in the show notes of this episode so folks can see. So last question for you. It's a question that I ask everybody. And it is, if there is a book or a film or really any other resource that's had an important influence on you, either personally or professionally, it can be related to education, but it doesn't have to be.
So now with my PhD, I don't have much time to read for pleasure.
I figured it would be academic.
But years ago, 1988, I think it was, Stand and Deliver. I love that movie. Stand and Deliver is about a professor, Edward James Olmos, who teaches, you know, calculus, teaches math in high school. And, you know, students don't want to be there. They don't want to learn. They have so much going on at home. And he finds a way, again, you know, with those relationships, teaches them, and they end up passing this really important state test, and only to get blamed that they cheated. Yeah. And so they have to retake the test. But that's a movie that I love. I love Stand and Deliver. Pretty old. I don't know if it's available.
Oh, I'm sure it's available. Yeah. That is a classic. I mean, that's a wonderful movie. And, you know, I've done, I think, probably 230 of these podcast episodes, and nobody's mentioned Stand and Deliver. I'm glad you did, because it is an amazing movie. I remember the scene. I don't know why I remember this scene vividly, but when they're in the really hot room taking the test and they're eating oranges.
Right.
You know,
at the end, they did it. You know, most of them, I believe, passed the test. So it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. Teach Like a Champion is a book that every teacher should read. Teach Like a Champion. I mean, the title says it all. And then, you know, it's on my bucket list of things I want to do. I want to be an author. I originally wanted to write a book for children. And now people are telling me, you should write about your story. Your story is amazing. You know, this child, this little girl who didn't speak English, was a second language learner, and became California Bilingual Teacher of the Year, and now National Teacher of the Year. So I don't know. I'm gonna find the time. I'm going to find the time to write a book that's on my things to do.
Well, I am sure we will talk between now and when you write a book. But when you write a book, I'm going to just go ahead and say publicly that I'm going to request that we talk again, do another episode about the book and certainly promote it. But that's a book that I would read regardless of how you decide to the direction that you decide to go.
My students did that at me. I share with my students, I'm going to be an author. I want to be an author. And you can all be authors. And they keep telling me, you have time. You had all summer. You need to write your book. And then during Christmas break, winter break, why didn't you write your book?
That's all it takes, right? Just
you
the winter.
Write your book.
So I love that. I love that. That's because they have high standards that you've instilled in them. So that's your own fault that they believe that you can do that in a summer or a winter, it sounds like. But I'm sure it's something that you will do. And I look forward to that. And with that, Sonia, thank you again for taking the time to chat with us. For those who are listening now, we're recording this episode, I think like 11 days before you go back to school. So things are really busy. So taking the time, I really appreciate it. And congratulations again on being the Kabe and Nabe Teacher of the Year. And thanks for sharing all the strategies that you talked about and your journey, personal journey, as well as the journey to the dual language school that you have now. And just sounds like you're doing amazing work. So much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. You know, this award means so much to me. People keep asking, how do you feel? What does it? It means so much. I was 5 years old when I knew I wanted to teach. It wasn't easy learning a second language. And in high school, people telling me, yeah, you shouldn't go to college. College is not for you. I used to cry. It wasn't easy. And now when I see my own kids, you know, struggling with homework, I tell them, come on, you speak English. I did it, and I didn't speak English in high school. So you know the language. Come on, you can do it. But it's been just wonderful meeting so many people and just sharing my story. I really hope to inspire others, not just students, anybody. I mean, just follow your dream. Anything is possible. You can do it. I did it. You can do it.
I'm sure you've inspired a few people who are listening to this, and you've definitely inspired me. So we will we'll keep in touch. I hope to do it again. And thank you so much. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community. Well, you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.